Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
Hi, listeners. I want to tell you about a cause that I'm involved with at Heritage Radio Network. HRN is celebrating its 15th year, and to celebrate, we're deepening our commitment to giving voice to the next generation of food system storytellers, and we need your help. Our internship and fellowship programs help activate new possibilities for underrepresented and underestimated young people through experiential journalism, audio engineering, and production training. Through these unique programs, HRN helps food equity stewards build essential workforce readiness skills that expand their potential and foster economic mobility. Please consider supporting these critical programs. And with a minimum donation, you can be entered to win a dinner for two at an amazing restaurant in one of eight cities and tickets to a concert at a great venue in one of those cities. We have incredible partners across the country who have donated, as they also share our passion for helping to educate the next generation of food system storytellers. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. And make sure you donate before March 31st. Thank you.
Hello, old friends. I'm Brian Brinkman.
I'm David Goldstein. It's August 30th of 2021. Getting to September. Gonna feel the fall chill very soon, and you should feel fortunate because you're listening to The Drop.
Welcome to the final Monday in August. I feel like we've been doing these in August forever at this point in time. I was in California at one point. Dave was on the Cape. Dave is now in Western Mass as of time of recording. I'm getting ready for Dick's. My son's in kindergarten. Dave's kids are about to go back to school. The construction is about to wrap up on my house. I mean, it's like so much has happened since we started the month of August. I can't believe that we're still here. We have fish shows on the horizon. We just had fish shows, but we have fish shows on the horizon, which is phenomenal. And I'm excited to be here. It's Monday. It's a new week. I get to see fish at the end of this week. Things are good, man. Things are good. Dave, how are you?
Not doing too bad. I am indeed in Northampton, Western Massachusetts. Of course, where indie rockers in their 30s go to retire. I'm not retired. I'm here for a week with my family. We're house-sitting for some good friends. We are going to actually drive up to northern Vermont tomorrow for a few days. Maybe I'll even get to make a pilgrimage to Burlington. It remains to be seen. But basically, for some odd reason, in New York City, school does not start this year until the 13th of September. So we are trying to keep my two daughters as occupied and off of the iPad and outside as much as possible, which necessitated a trip outside of Manhattan. So
it's been kind of an eventful week or so here on my front. Last time we did an episode, my son had just started kindergarten, which was hyper emotional and just an incredible experience for me to watch and just see him like get adapted. Of course, within like 3 or 4 days, he came home with a cold. Some kid at school was coughing and sneezing, which I don't know why that kid didn't stay home. But, you know, it's the first week of school. school sent us an email because we kept Wallace home from school on Monday. We're like, hey, you've got to get a COVID test because we want to make sure that everyone is okay. And we got these protocols. Totally awesome. Totally fine with it. So I go into Walgreens. I haven't really bought a COVID test since we started this whole pandemic thing. I just haven't needed one. We followed the rules and stayed home and, you know, did all that sort of thing throughout 2020. Then I got vaccinated. So I go and I get the COVID test. I had to get three tests, so you can only get four tests. So I get two packages. $52, man. No wonder this thing is out of control. What in the hell is going on? $52 for a COVID test? Are you fucking kidding me?
Abbott Labs is raking you across the coals. Yeah, those are pretty expensive. They're largely sold out across New York City as well.
Yeah, I had to go to three different Walgreens. It's just like, man, I understand everyone's got a buck to make, and I'm sure the technology to make these rapid tests, it clearly took us way too long because we didn't have them a year ago. It's an amazing technology, but like, let's reduce the cost on that. Let's subsidize the cost on this. Like, the vaccines are free. Let's make sure that we know if people have COVID or not. I feel like that would help stop the spread of Delta right now, don't you?
Yeah, certainly part of it. I mean, I think what will really stop the spread of Delta is people getting vaccinated, not taking cow and horse dewormer in light of getting vaccinated.
This is a good point. You raise a really good point here. But in alternative to that, if people could at least know in a cheap and affordable way that they have COVID, I think that that would help us out as well.
Yeah, no, that would absolutely help. We had to do the rapid test before we went to Cape Cod. My sister wanted some assurance that none of us had COVID, so we all took the rapid test. I actually took a PCR, and my daughter took a PCR. But no, we took the rapid test, and they seemed to work because they said we were negative and we felt pretty good. So that gave us a little extra peace of mind going into that part of the August vacation.
Well, speaking of a Q-tip up your nose, how are the New York Mets doing?
The New York Mets, it's like, it'd be like if you were getting the Q-tip up your nose and then instead of after 10 seconds, you're like, aha, another 10 seconds. Woohoo, another 10 seconds. So before you know it, it's like 40 seconds of the nurse putting the Q-tip up your nose and your eyes are crying and you're screaming, but you can't look away. That's like the New York Mets. As of recording, the game is actually tied. They're playing the San Francisco Giants. Gabe Kapler, silly hipster fool. The Giants are the team of destiny again once again this year. The game is tied right now, but the Mets are, they're very bad and they're going nowhere fast, and there's going to be some big changes in the offseason. That's a good metaphor for being a Mets fan. It's kind of like the PCR test that won't ever go away.
Well, the Cubs won their first game at home in just over a month and then walked off homer for the first time in 2 years. So, you know, it's, I know what we're in for right now. I'm just rooting for other teams.
The Cubs play some ridiculous, like, never-ending extra inning game against Colorado.
Yeah, you know, amazing work by MLB TV. I couldn't watch it living here in Denver, so I have no idea really what happened. I did watch, I was watching the Dodgers-Padres game last night when you hear this, and I went to bed around, I don't know, 11. Game was in like the sixth inning, and I woke up for some reason, got some water at like 1:30, 2 o'clock, and I just checked Twitter, which you should never do, but in this scenario, it actually helped out. And I just saw all like Jeff Passan's tweets about how crazy this baseball game was. And I was like, he just tweeted that 2 minutes ago. So I checked the MLB app, and the Dodgers and Padres were in the 16th inning, which I didn't think was possible with the runner on second, but apparently it is. And it was a phenomenal end to the game. It was a really wild, wacky baseball game. And we're at that time of the year where, like, you know, if you're the Dodgers or the Padres, you can't lose, especially if you're the Padres right now. And we're entering September, which September-October baseball, the only time of year that rivals this is April, May, and early June for basketball for me. This is my favorite time of year for sports, and I'm so excited.
So this is going up on Monday, August 30th. You'll have had the three Friday, Saturday, Sunday shows at the Gorge. And, of course, they were supposed to be followed by Tahoe on Tuesday and Wednesday. But there was the Caldor Fire, which is turning the Tahoe and the surrounding area in kind of to an unfortunate, fiery, smoky hellscape. But as we found out yesterday, the shows are actually going to take place at the Shoreline Amphitheater. So Fish went ahead and decided to reschedule the two shows for Shoreline, which is about 4 hours from Tahoe. It looks like the Water Wheel Foundation, all donations are going to be go to helping the victims of the Caldor Fire. They certainly took lemons, and I think they made lemonade. I've never been to Shoreline. It's hosted many good Fish shows over the years, certainly many decent Dead shows, and I think the late 80s and 90s. But that's kind of a cool thing as an alternative to having those shows get canceled.
Yeah, I think it's a great move. I mean, I didn't really want to speculate through this because, you know, so many of us are outside of the window of expertise here, either be it forest fires or kind of the legal ramifications of canceling and or rescheduling shows. But I kind of felt like with everything the band had been through, if they're going to cancel these shows, they're going to at least try to reschedule them or at least try to find an alternative venue, be it in Reno or San Francisco. It was great that they were able to book it at Shoreline. Shoreline historically has had some phenomenal shows. You've got the 73197, incredible, incredible full show, might be the best show of that summer. 99 had Phil Lesh, obviously 1.0 ended at Shoreline. 2.0, they open up their first show at Shoreline with You Enjoy Myself. And then they haven't played there very much in 3.0, but there's a really highly, highly underrated Down With Disease from the 2009 show at Shoreline, August 5th. And the second set from the 2015 show, July 24th, 2015, is one of my absolute favorite sets of that entire summer tour, which is my favorite tour of 3.0. So I'm really excited to like see that a surprise visit, first two-night run at Shoreline since 2003, Tuesday, Wednesday night. I mean, it has all the makings of the band really just like knocking it out of the park.
Anyway, Brian, what have you watched on television lately?
So I started watching two shows that have been recommended to me. One of them was recommended to me a long, long time ago. The other one had been recommended to me very aggressively over the last couple of weeks. Ted Lasso, which I feel like every single person told me to watch over the last year. And God damn, man, I am a cynical, cynical dude. And within 5 minutes, the endearing nature of Ted Lasso totally won me over. And it's exactly the show I need right now. It's 30 minutes. It's about soccer. Jason Sudeikis is great. There's a bunch of like biting, snippy British humor that I really enjoy. It's very inclusive. It's very much like the kind of show that we need right now. And I'm not going to be a Grinch about this. I'm not going to be a Scrooge. I'm going to embrace the optimism, the positivity that Ted Lasso provides. So I've been enjoying that. And then I also started The White Lotus, which is a show about very wealthy white people that vacation at a high-end resort in Hawaii. And I'm only two episodes into it, so I haven't gotten to the crux of the season. I don't know exactly how it's going to turn out. I mean, I have an idea about where it's going. But it's a really fascinating depiction of white privilege and kind of fucked up families and the expectation that comes with spending money. And I hate it because it makes me cringe half the time that I'm watching it, because I've seen myself in these situations and I've seen myself react in this sort of way, which is just trying to be honest. It's not something I'm necessarily proud of. But in and of that, it's entertaining in the same way that like a Jonathan Franzen novel is.
Yeah, there's definitely a huge undercurrent of Jonathan Franzen running through the White Lotus, which I finished. I very much enjoyed that show. I thought season one of Ted Lasso was fantastic. Season two, okay, not warming up to it quite as much, lacking a little bit in the conflict department, kind of once you've gotten the feel for the sheer kindness of Ted Lasso, season two's floundering for me a bit. I still enjoy it. We'll see where it goes. We're halfway through at this point. But yeah, I absolutely did enjoy White Lotus. I'm kind of rooting around for something else to watch at this point. Having
These are like the first two TV shows I've enjoyed, and I can't tell you how long. Like, I tried to watch the QAnon documentary. Last year I watched The Vow. I've ended up getting to a point where I literally just like have baseball or basketball on with music playing in the background. and I haven't really gotten into a TV show. So I'm enjoying having two TV shows that like I'm enjoying watching and seeing as the stories develop, but also like thinking about as I go through my day. And that's kind of the point of like a good television show is like, how does this apply to my life and how do little lessons of it and little like conflicts within it wormhole their way into my mind. Well, why don't we transition here and talk a bit about the big releases in Osiris land that we have been listening to. Dave, what have you been spinning from Osiris Media here in the last week?
Okay, so the most recent thing I was listening to was Osiris has a podcast called Moods and Modes, and it is hosted by a guy named Alex Skolnick, who's a guitarist, probably best known as the guitarist in the seminal Bay Area thrash metal gods Testament. He was a founding member of that band. I think he was with them for a long time, may have left, may have come back, not entirely sure. But more recently, he's kind of become a jazz guitarist as well. So he's gone from playing thrash metal to playing jazz. I think he also published a book a few years ago. He's a fascinating jack of all trades. And basically what he does on the show, I think once a month, is he kind of, talks about, it's a music podcast where he often features other guitarists, or it's really kind of in-depth, serious levels of nerdery. And in the most recent episode, what he does, it's a big tribute to the late guitarist Leslie West, who died in December of 2020 at the age of 75. Now, Leslie West is probably best known for being the guitarist of the heavy power trio Mountain, which existed in the late 60s, early 70s. I think they put out two, possibly three records. And Leslie West, he sort of never really got his due. He's kind of should be more credited with bringing really heavy mainstream music to the masses in the early 70s. He's an incredible guitar player, and while I'm fairly familiar with Mountain's discography, of course, probably if you listen to classic rock radio, you know the song Mississippi Queen. They had a song called Long Red, which was sampled in Jay-Z's 99 Problems. Nantucket Sleigh Ride, one of my favorite songs ever, and one that's been ripped off by indie jams left and right. And I don't think enough indie jam bands rip off Nantucket Sleigh Ride, frankly. But really, what I was not familiar with, which really Alex Skolnick gets into on the podcast, is the power trio that Leslie West made with Jack Bruce from Cream after Mountain, being called West, Lang, and Bruce, being Corky Lang, being Mountain's drummer. And he kind of did a deep dive into their first record and just how it influenced everyone from Kiss to AC/DC and just didn't get nearly enough appreciation. And it's really, he does this via snippets of interviews with Leslie West. He does a lot of research into Leslie West's background. It's just a really interesting, well put together podcast from a genius guitarist paying tribute to one other genius guitarist. So I found it engrossing, and Game recognizes Game. And yeah, I would highly recommend you check out that most recent episode of Alex Skolnick's Moods and Modes on Osiris.
Yeah, I love that podcast, and I highly recommend it as well. I'm going to recommend a show I've been wanting to recommend since we started this podcast, but he didn't put it on an episode since we went live, and that is Phil Freeman's Burning Ambulance. Phil Freeman is a really great music writer and podcaster, and he has been running the Burning Ambulance podcast definitely since Osiris Media began, and probably before that. I think he had a backlog before Osiris actually started. But this is one of my favorite podcasts we have here. Phil Freeman interviews musicians from the world of jazz, metal, modern composition, noise, and more. He's got a very laid-back music writer type of approach. He knows his stuff. He asks very simple, very straightforward questions, allows the interviewee to really expound upon themselves. He doesn't try to get in the way of the conversation, and you end up walking away from it. Like, it's one of those podcasts where you just kind of feel kind of calm, as well as like you're learning a ton in a very short amount of time. And you kind of walk away with a very new perspective on music. And he had this really great interview recently with Andrew Cyrille, who, as he notes, is the last man standing from the first wave of free jazz. He played with John Coltrane, Albert Eiler, Cecil Taylor in the mid-1960s, and has been recording continuously up to today, including recordings with Bill Frisell in the late 2010s. I really enjoy. It's a really cool conversation. Cyrille is getting up there in years, and like his wisdom and his patience and his humility when he talks about the music that he has played throughout his life and the people that he's played with, it's really inspiring. You know, you accomplish a lot, but like, why do you need to say very much about it? Why do you need to, you know, really expound upon it? Just like, this is what happened, this is what I did, and move on. And so it lends itself as a kind of an inspirational podcast, but also really informative. He talks a lot about leadership within a band, and you know, really knowing who is running the jam, who's running the song, who's running the session, and if it's you, being completely out there and in charge. If it's someone else, you follow their ideas. And it really kind of reshaped in my head in a lot of ways, you know, how to think about a lot of free jazz and a lot of, you know, 1960s jazz movements that I really enjoy. So I definitely enjoyed this episode. I love what Phil Freeman does, and I highly recommend all of you out there check out Burning Ambulance.
Absolutely. Just also want to say that Phil Freeman is responsible for doing a column on Stereo Gum called Ugly Beauty, the Month in Jazz. And that's a fantastic column. I look towards that to get many jazz recommendations.
All right. So for the meat of this episode, we were kind of thinking back, you know, we're almost 10 episodes into this whole thing. We figured, you know, probably a good time for us to kind of step back and talk about how we discover music. We use this podcast as a kind of leaping off point to talk about what's going on in our lives, what are we listening to. And the back half of every episode always features new album recommendations as well as classic album recommendations. And we want to kind of dive deep into our approach to finding new music. It's a question that both of us get, be it in DMs, be it over Twitter all the time, texts from friends. And I think that it's something that like is beneficial because sometimes it can feel so overwhelming to try to discover new music, to get outside of your comfort zone. And we wanted to kind of share our thoughts. Dave, I want to ask you first, what is like the simplest approach for you in terms of discovering new music?
I think it really all comes down to who I trust, which is, I say, there's be certain writers out there, certain critics, certain websites that I've just dealt with over time and know that they're not going to give me any bullshit and they'll give it to me straight. And if they share interests that are similar to mine, like, for example, it's one thing to go to the website and say something like a Pitchfork. But if you go to that site enough times, you tend to recognize certain names or certain writers over and over. And if those writers like the same things that you like and tend to rate things similarly, then you can, you know, you can trust that something's going to be good. I guess I always think of, for an example, the Pitchfork writer who's also one of the hosts of the Osiris podcast, Late Era, San Sadomsky. Excellent guy, very smart guy, very good writer. And often my tastes tend to overlap with his. So if he's going to put out a review and I see that he likes something, then I'll just go listen to it because I'm assured that it's certainly going to be good. Similarly, earlier in this episode, we were talking about Phil Freeman with the Burning Ambulance podcast. I said he has that fantastic jazz column, Stereo Gum. I know that he's not going to recommend something unless it's good. So I will go and listen to those records. I mean, certain blogs that we go to all the time, things like Aquarian Drunkard blog, the Stereo Gum website, even things, other podcasts, things like our buddy Stephen Hayden, who hosts the Indie Mixtape podcast, which, full disclosure, Brian does some of the editing for. That's another example of something. If those guys are talking about something that's good, I will certainly check it out. But really, there's a lot of information out there. There's a lot of blogs. There's a lot of different radio stations you can listen to. Really, for me, it just comes down to who you know and who you can trust and who your tastes overlap with enough that if something is recommended, you know it's going to be good without too much hesitation.
I think that's a really nice and succinct way to say it. I would say as well, we talked about this a couple episodes ago in regards to Bandcamp. You know, utilizing a website like Bandcamp allows you the opportunity to really kind of expand where you're getting your listening information, kind of discovering artists that nobody is recommending to you, and really kind of trusting your gut and trusting your own direction. I think to your point, you know, blogs, other podcasts, following people who have great taste on Twitter. I've really spent the last couple of months curating my overall Twitter feed. So like when I log on there, I kind of get the news that I want, I get the music recommendations I want, and I get the sports analysis that I want. And that's really it. It's really used as like a resource. So trying to follow people who I know are consistently going to just post an image of an album, that the album cover may look good, or they may say, I cannot believe I haven't heard this album before. This is incredible. And then you check it out, or this is my favorite record I've been listening to this week. I try to do that as much as possible, because I know that, you know, there are people that will follow me that will say, oh my God, I'm going to listen to that record as a result of this. So, you know, I definitely have people who I follow via social media for those recommendations alone. I think the other thing, two things I'll say. One is have an open mind. I find a lot of the time I will go and just listen to a record because either someone I know recommended it or because the source seems like a good source to trust. Even if I know in my head, I probably am not going to love this, but who knows? Like it may just like, you may be in a very unique headspace and, you know, you may be in a position where like something that you would never have really enjoyed in any other setting ends up being something that really hits you in that moment. So I tend to love that. The other thing I'm a huge proponent of are artist deep dives. And the reason why I bring this up, even though you're going to be listening to a single artist in this setting, reading about each album as you're listening to it, I'm currently listening to every single Rolling Stones album in a row, and reading about every single Rolling Stones album, especially the early ones, there's so much information about their influences and the blues music that these guys were listening to, the Chicago blues that they were listening to in the early 60s. And there are so many artists and there's so many records mentioned just in a Wikipedia page that have me making lists of like where I need to go next from here. So that, a genre deep dive, like that sort of stuff tends to help me immensely to both dive fully into one artist, but also kind of expand where my listening goes.
Yeah, I would say artist deep dives can be extremely fun. When you have an artist with a huge discography like the Rolling Stones, like a Bob Dylan, or even like a prog rock band like Rush or Yes, it's always just fun to take a period, listen to the progression. I like looking at the All Music Guide when I'm reading, listening to an album. It's really fun just to really hit Wikipedia, hit All Music, and just do interesting deep dives into these artists. I'll probably have to start a Rolling Stones deep dive sooner or later at this point. Also, what else? I would say lots of independent radio stations that can basically play what they want to play are lots of fun. For example, there's KEXP. That's a great indie rock station. Of course, there's the venerable WFMU, Freeform Radio, kind of whatever you want to listen to. For those of us who do have Sirius XM, we recently got a new car, so we have Sirius. I'm having fun exploring those stations, although I will say that the first wave alternative, 80s alternative rock station, basically only plays Depeche Mode and whatever else other than Depeche Mode. It's basically all Depeche Mode and Big Audio Dynamite and Joe Jackson with some other stuff thrown in for kicks. But relative to terrestrial radio, just going through all the different satellite stations, those can kind of be fun to just see what crops up. But really, kind of like Brian was saying, certain people on Twitter, anybody who I follow, if they have album recommendations, I'll probably check those out. Anytime my friends get really excited about something, they'll send me a Spotify link. I'll check that out. Someone wants to send me a Bandcamp link. Because, really, I mean, discovering other music, it's just most fun from your peers and people that you respect. And just the going back and forth. I mean, for me, the most fun is I just feel a buzz in my pocket and pick it up. And Brian will say, you got to listen to this record. And I'll drop what I'm doing, provided it doesn't put my children in danger, and I'll listen to that record.
I think that's a really good point as well, like trusting your friends. Like part of the joy, Dave and I talked about this on Beyond the Pond a lot, and it spills over now into the drop. Part of the joy of like our friendship has been like there are a lot of records that we will recommend to each other that are up both of our wheelhouses. But like there's definitely a lot of musical avenues that I will go down a little bit more extreme than Dave or vice versa. And, you know, if Dave sends me like a hardcore record or like a doom metal record, it's not really something that any other friends are going to be recommending to me, but it's something that like I will absolutely listen to because of Dave's recommendation. Similarly, I've got a good buddy, shout out to John McGar, who will send a lot of like kind of 60s English folk psychedelic music, and he'll just like go down these rabbit holes and he'll just like send six or seven records at a time. And I'll just throw them on whenever, you know, I'm kind of like, I don't know what I want to listen to. I could listen to these, you know, this Grateful Dead show or this Fish show that I'm always interested in listening to and could always be on in the background. Or I could potentially find something new that, you know, I've never heard before. And that joy of like a friend passes you a record because it affected them, you listening to it, now it affects you. It's just like another layer of the friendship that builds that, it's, you know, I would say, you know, beyond just like the joy of listening to music, it's a huge part of why most of my close friends are very much into music the way that I am.
See, I just want to add some specifics about certain blogs and radio shows that we do tend to listen to find some new things. Of course, if you're listening to The Drop, you're probably familiar with the Aquarium Drunkard blog. If you're not, absolutely should be. So certainly check out Aquarium Drunkard. It's incredible writing, great variety of records. I think they've also branched out in the podcast at this point. There's another website, a blog called Raven Sings the Blues, which sort of tends to veer very indie jam, very, very indie psych, a lot of the stuff that we love listening to and talking about. I recently discovered on Instagram, there's an Instagram account called Dad Rock Etc., and I've kind of learned about a surprising number of good dad rock bands that I would not have heard of before otherwise. I think it's a dad. I think he's some guy who appears to be in his early to mid-40s like myself, just kind of randomly posting these bands. It actually turns out to be a pretty good resource. Our buddy Jeff Conklin, he used to have a radio show called The Avant Ghetto on WFMU. Now he has a newer show called The Trailhead, which I believe is done out of the radio station up at Vassar. Now he lives in the Hudson Valley. That's an invaluable resource for folk, indie psych, new stuff, old stuff. Just some really good things to listen to. And we love the NYC Taper website, nyctaper.com. It's a crew based out of New York. They tape each and everything that we would consider to be a really good rock show in the greater New York area. You can probably find it up there. That's an invaluable resource for live music and some really good essays on Sam Music as well.
Yeah, I would just add one more. Similarly, from Aquarium Drunkard, Jason P. Woodbury has been an invaluable resource for me in terms of album and artist recommendations through his show Range and Basin, which I listen to whenever it comes out. It's one of my favorite podcasts out there. It's not publicly distributed. You've got to be a Patreon member, but it's highly, highly worth it. It's like $3 a month through Aquarium Drunkard, and it's one of those shows that like I never have any idea who he's playing, but the sonic landscapes that he's exploring always draw me in and always send me to Bandcamp to check out new artists and tend to find artists that I would not have found otherwise and end up kind of reshaping and rescrambling my brain. So yeah, I think, you know, similar to what we said towards the end of our Bandcamp conversation a couple weeks ago, hit us up if there's any other questions you have. We're always willing to talk with listeners here just with regards to how you're discovering and how you're learning about new music. But hopefully this conversation helps you all, you know, in terms of direction towards discovering new music. All right. So on the topic of how do we learn about new music, we're going to talk about some new music that we've been digging over the last week or so. David, what is the new album that you would like to recommend this week?
So in the last episode of The Drop, we had talked about there was going to be a new Sturgill Simpson record coming out last Friday. And it did indeed come out. He put out a new record called The Ballad of Dude and Juanita, which kind of, I've been listening to it now for about a week. It certainly kind of follows in the bluegrass style slash like Appalachian folk of his last two Cutting Grass volumes, 1 and 2 records, in which he decided to reinterpret his own songbook in the bluegrass style. I think the bands are largely the same as well. And this is kind of, I guess you could call it a concept album. It's about two individuals around the time of the Civil War. I think it's actually meant to be a tribute to his grandparents, but it takes place in time about 100 years before they were alive. Now, I haven't been listening to the lyrics all that closely, but I guess, dude, Sturgill says that he's as hard as the nails in Jesus' hands. And when he says that, there's like a hammer. You hear it like banging on a nail, which is kind of funny. So this record, when I first got it, I said, why is it only 28 minutes long? I mean, usually Sturgill Simpson, this is his fifth album. He says he's actually only going to make 5 albums under his own name. That's supposed to be his plan. And, you know, they've each been pretty big opuses from his second album, Meta Modern Sounds and Country Music, which I still think is his best album, to Sailor's Guide to Earth, then the very loud and very skronky and quite hilarious Sounded Fury. So, Ballad of Dude and Juanita, it's a little more modest than that. 28 minutes, entirely acoustic. But what's good about this record, I'm finding, is that it's very pleasing to the ear. It's extremely well produced. So you can hear every acoustic instrument, every banjo pluck, every pluck of the mouth harp, all the harmony vocals, everything is crystal clear. It's kind of one of the best produced, best recorded albums I've heard in a while. And it has no filler. Like, every song is good and catchy and moves the story along, and it's kind of over before you realize it, and you just press play and start it over again. It's very pleasant little album that kind of lends itself to several replays because of the 28-minute runtime, but none of it feels forced and none of it really feels overwrought. So I think he kind of knew what he was doing with that short album runtime. You know, it's very, I keep coming back to the word pleasant. It sounds good in the car, and while it doesn't quite have, I don't know, the heft of like a Sailor's Guide to Earth, for example, it's you know, a very good addition to his discography, and anybody who's liked what he's done in the past will enjoy it. And I'm curious to see where he goes next. I can't imagine him retiring from music entirely, although I know he's definitely done some more focus on acting as of late. I know he's going to be in this forthcoming Scorsese movie, Killers of the Flower Moon, which I'm looking forward to very much. But yeah, if he decides to be part of a band, or if he decides to do, I will follow him. So Check that out.
One and all had heard the stories, and our witness had been sworn about a man born in Hartbury back in June of 29. Must have got that Martin Malin muzzle the day he was born. Things he could do with that rifle: blow the balls off a bat, reload and shoot it one more time. Had a monster of a mule, was a mighty fine steed. Sham Sam, that tomahawk and that flintlock's all he need. Finding food and finding trouble and always taking heat. Any man crossed him was sure.
Absolutely been loving that Sturgill Simpson record, and it feels like the kind of record that is just going to be there for us as we move into autumn and is going to hit perfectly come autumn. So I'm really excited to have that to look forward to and to listen to here the next couple of months. I'm going to recommend a record that is right in my wheelhouse, and that is because it is a pedal steel ambient record.
Yeah.
It is the album title is The Desert is Paper Thin. The artist is Corntuth. I found this on Bandcamp about a week or so ago. Brief insight. I, you know, put my kids down around 8 o'clock at night, usually watch some baseball, maybe some TV till about 11, get into bed. And the first thing I do when I get into bed is I go to Bandcamp and see what is recommended on the main page, and kind of scroll through, listen to a few tracks here and there. And whenever I come across something that I love, I put my phone down, lay down, close my eyes, and listen to it. And if it appeals, it ends up being a record that tends to be in my wheelhouse for the next couple of days, rotation for the next couple of days. And this record was one of those. This was absolutely perfect to fall asleep to, and it was has been a really pleasant listen as I've been working through like a lot of edits over the last couple of weeks and just doing a ton of stuff around the house. So it's a really gorgeous album. Fans of William Tyler, fans of Steve Gunn will absolutely love this work. As I'm looking at the Bandcamp page right now, of the record page, there is someone with a Fishman Donut Bandcamp icon, as well as someone with a Steal Your Face icon who clearly likes this record. So it's definitely one of those records that's like-minded for those of us that enjoy the experimentations of Fish and the Dead in ambient territory. Of note, Corntuth put out a record last November called Music to Work To. Both Music to Work To and The Desert is Paper Thin features this very simplistic, almost like medieval Japanese artwork. The album cover for The Desert is Paper Thin is like a sun that's setting with just some smoke coming up on this very beige, very simple album cover. I love looking at it, and it just looks the way that the record sounds. The Music to Work To album is very similar in that sense. So highly recommend this. It is just one of my total wheelhouse records, and I've definitely been loving it here. It's definitely one of those records that's going to linger, I think, as we move into the album ranking portion of 2021, which we will be getting to in the coming season.
Gosh, Brian, a pedal steel ambient record. You don't have enough of those.
Can never have enough of those, man.
Never have enough ambient pedal steel records. No, certainly not. So, we've been doing our five-year look backwards in terms of classic summer albums. And now we're back at 1986. Man, I was 6 years old. I wouldn't turn seven until September. This was the summer of the New York Mets taking over New York City. one toot at a time, if you get what I'm saying. And my God, 1986 was a huge year for this, like, yuppie AOR cocaine rock. This is the year that Eddie Money put out the Can't Hold Back record. Genesis had Invisible Touch. Steve Winwood back in the High Life. Tina Turner had Break Every Rule. Bon Jovi, Slippery When Wet. All this, like, loud, boisterous stuff. I mean, God, the Eddie Money record. Take Me Home Tonight. Want to Go Back. Hit after hit after hit. Seriously. Look at that record. Listen to that if you haven't in a while. It's totally cornball, but I fucking love Eddie Money, man. The album from 1986 that I'm going to talk about, because I remember when my dad first put it on in the car and he asked me if I knew who the lead singer was. And I said, yeah, this is Sammy Hagar, Dad. Somehow I was 6 years old. I knew who Sammy Hagar was. Don't ask me how. But Van Halen's 5150. Now, there's a lot of people who say, no David Lee Roth, no Van Halen. And they just dismissively refer to the Sammy Hagar era as Van Hagar. And I certainly get that. I understand that. But 5150, that was the first Sammy Hagar record. It just can't be denied. That album is just anthem after anthem, hit after hit, and that completely soundtracked my six-year-old summer as I was watching every New York Mets game and probably going to bed in the sixth or seventh inning as I was only 6 years old, and the New York Mets couldn't lose. And when you listen to songs like The Best of Both Worlds and Dreams, we had that video with the Blue Angels, you too will feel like you cannot lose. I mean, Dreams is my dad is a huge Van Halen fan. He loves Eddie Van Halen. He's very sad when he died. He thinks that Dreams is probably his favorite Van Halen song of all time. And that includes all the, like David Lee Roth song, just because it is an undeniable anthem. I mean, this record's got Summer Nights, as in Summer Nights in My Radio. That's like the ultimate hanging out on the porch with your boys song. The opening track, Good Enough, Why Can't This Be Love, which had Eddie Van Halen's big dalliance into the Yamaha DX7 playing all the synthesizers. It's just something to blare extremely loudly. And although Van Hagar never made an album this good ever again, it would be impossible to improve on perfection on the first try. It's kind of just everything I want my 80s classic rock albums to be. I know I turned you onto that record, right, Brian?
Yeah, you know, last summer when Eddie Van Halen passed, well, it was before that, I exposed my ignorance and called Van Halen a hair metal band about a year and a half ago. And Dave properly scoffed at me and was like, they may have played like bigger than life shows and albums in the 1980s, but the talent was far beyond anything that you would have heard in any sort of standard hair metal band. And around the time, I think it was right after Eddie Van Halen passed away, I was like, okay, I need to do a deep dive. And told me to listen to Van Halen, Van Halen 2, 1984, and 5150. And I listened to all of them in an evening, and I just felt like I was fucking on top of the world. And this record, you're absolutely right in saying it. Like, there is something about the kind of grungy, dirty, you know, aspect of the David Lee Roth era. And there's almost like no rock band that's ever sounded like Van Halen in that era. It's kind of like you took like the Stones and Zeppelin and like added some gloss, but like added 10 years where it was like, look what I can do with my fucking guitar. And you get this like record that's just, it was made for Guitar Center. And then 7 years later, you get 5150. And it's like all of the technology of the 80s latched onto this incredibly talented band. It's such a huge, larger than life record. And I absolutely loved it.
Yeah. Sammy Hagar, he's a pro's pro. He's a professional. He had much larger vocal range than David Lee Roth. And while he wasn't quite the crazy, lecherous, incredibly charismatic party animal that David Lee Roth was, he did bring an era aura of arena rock professionalism to the band, I guess you could say. Which some people thought was their downfall. But at least for that one record, it was pretty incredible.
It worked there. Yeah, so 1986, I was 1 year old. We are probably 18 to 24 months shy of U2's The Joshua Tree really having a massive impact on me, which was one of the first records to really hit me. Probably same amount of distance away from Bruce Springsteen's title track, Tunnel of Love. For some reason, that was one of my first favorite songs ever. But I was looking in the summer of 1986, and my favorite artist of all time released a record that I feel like I need to defend. And I feel like I'm going to shout out one of my favorite podcasts right now. Not part of Osiris, but one of my favorite podcasts, the Jokermen podcast. I see you guys out there. They have rated this record, I think, if not the worst Bob Dylan album ever. I know that our friend of the pod, Stephen Hyden, rated this the worst Bob Dylan album out there. But definitely down towards the bottom of the barrel. I have an affection for this record, and I don't know if it's because like I feel like I'm one of the only people who loves Bob Dylan and is in this album's corner, but I love this record. I did a Bob Dylan full discographical deep dive last year, and when I got to the 1980s, I don't want to say that they're a slog, but like between Infidels and Oh Mercy, it is definitely a lot of like, so what the hell were you trying to do here, Bob? I'm trying to follow the narrative. I can't totally follow the narrative. Synthesizers don't really work with your music, but I'm here for you, man. And because of that, Empire Burlesque and Down in the Groove, the two albums that are on either side of Knocked Out Loaded, didn't really do anything for me. They sounded like a mess. They sounded like an artist who had no idea about where he wanted to go with his career. I think I had Down in the Groove as my least favorite Bob Dylan album there is. And in between is this kind of ramshackle, poorly produced, but somewhat endearing album. Feels like a mishmash of songs in a way that actually works. Knocked Out Loaded, an album that begins with kind of a cowboy tune, You Want to Ramble, before moving into a Kris Kristofferson song, They Killed Him, which is like this testament to fallen human rights advocates throughout world history, Mahatma Gandhi, even Jesus Christ, features this massive chorus. Drifting Too Far from the Shore, which feels to me like it's 15 years ahead of its time for Dylan as he would get into like the Americana songbook. You re-record this song in like 2006 and it fits a lot differently, even though he has never played it since 1988. Maybe Someday as a record, there is a song that he quotes T.S. Eliot in, and I absolutely love the song. But the album is best known for, and rightly so, the 11-minute song that kicks off side two, Brownsville Girl, which he wrote with Sam Shepard. It is one of my absolute favorite Bob Dylan songs. It is one of his best long-form songs. He interrupts like most of the narrative of this song to talk about a Western movie starring Gregory Peck that he has been having on his mind and has been kind of like filtering throughout his head as he goes through his life. This is a song that has been recorded by Bonnie Prince Billy, performed live by him numerous times. It's an incredible, epic Dylan song, and it's kind of one of those moments in the 1980s. You can kind of tie it to the Trouble No More tour, to Infidels, to the recording of When the Night Comes Falling from the Sky that didn't make it onto Empire Burlesque, and obviously the moment that he connected with Daniel Lanois and sat down to record Oh Mercy in New Orleans, where you really see the genius that is still within Bob Dylan, that is there regardless the flaws, regardless the dead ends, regardless the wrong turns. You hear the guy who in 10 years is going to make Time Out of Mind, 15 years is going to make Love and Theft, 35 years, excuse me, is going to make Rough and Rowdy Ways. It's that moment in Dylan's career where he's reinventing himself, but he's still got that brilliance. So Knocked Out Loaded is a record that, based on the album cover, based on the reception, I think it has a 2 out of 5 on the All Music Guide. Rolling Stone gave it 3 out of 5, but the Rolling Stone album guide gave it 1 out of 5. It is not a loved record. but it is a record that I will stand for and I will fight for. I highly, highly recommend checking out at least once Bob Dylan's Knocked Out Loaded. I didn't know that you'd be a leader. Oh, you thought you were talking to me. I figure maybe we're even, or maybe I'm one up on you. I send you all my money, just like I did before. I tried to eat you, honey, but you're drifting too far from shore. Drifting too far from shore. All right, so thus concludes another week of The Drop. I want to thank you guys all for hanging with us here. It's always fun for us to record this show. It's always fun for us to produce this show and release it for you all. Thanks, everyone who comments on this. Quick release schedule note. We will not be releasing an episode next week. We'll be releasing one the second week of September. Combination of I'm working on the finishing touches of the first few episodes of Undermine Season 2, as well as I will be attending the Dick shows this upcoming weekend here over Labor Day. We won't have the ability to make this show what it is, so we're going to take a brief pause. We'll be back the following week to probably talk about the end of Fish Summer Tour, as well as share a bunch of music and podcasts we've been listening to.
Absolutely. You guys deserve a quick break. I think we deserve a break. So yeah, we'll be back in 2 weeks. Absolutely looking forward to Dick's weekend. I will probably be watching those at home on my couch in the dark with everyone else in the household asleep, which is exactly how I want it to be. But if you've gotten to this point, thank you very much for hanging us with us on this week on The Drop. We hope we did not bore you too much. We hope you were able to use this to discover some new music. And please, come back in 2 weeks. We'll hold hands. We'll maybe sing Kumbaya. And we'll go forth on The Drop.
What's up, everybody? I am Finn McKenty, host of the Punk Rock NBA podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media podcast network. My podcast is all about doing what you love for a living, and every week I sit down and talk to people who have done exactly that. For example, musicians like Tommy from Between the Buried and Me, Matt from Periphery, Lil Lotus and Shinigami, among many others, photographers, artists, designers, YouTubers like Glenn Fricker and Sarah Dici, and I unpack exactly how they got to where they are today with the goal of helping you do the same. So if that sounds cool, you can listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com, and I'll see you there.
The number you have reached is 100.7 WMMS.
It wasn't just a radio station, it was a lifestyle.
Cleveland is a rock and roll city for sure.
I do like chocolate.
Get down!
The Wrath of the Buzzard. WMMS. Cleveland.
The rise and fall of one of the most iconic radio stations in America. Profiles. The Wrath of the Buzzard. PROH Files. Subscribe now wherever you get podcasts.